ज्ञानम जनशलाकया चाक्षुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः। नाम श्रेष्ठं मनुमापि सच्चिपुत्रं मत्रस्वरूपं रूपं तस्याग्रजमुरूपुलिं माथुरीं गोष्ठावतीं राधाकुन्दं गिरिवरम् राधिकमधावशं प्रप्तो यस्या प्रतिज्ञगृहाय श्रीगुरुं तं नतोऽस्मि। वञ्चाकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपा सिन्धुभ्यैव च पतितानं पवानेभ्य वैष्णवेभ्य नमो नमः। निखिलाश्रुतिमौले रत्नमालयते निराजितपदपङ्कजन्त आजे मुक्तकुलैरुपश्यामनं परितस्त्वं हरिणां संश्रयामि। अनार्पितचरीं चिरात् करुणयावतरणाकलौ सामर्पयितमुन्नतजबलरासं स्वभक्तिश्रियम्। हरिपुरता सुन्दरद्युतिकदम्बसन्दीपितः सदा हृदये खन्दरे स्फुरतो वासठिनन्दना। जानुलम्बिता भुजो कनकावदतो सङ्कीर्तनैकपितरो कमलायतक्षु विश्वाम्बरो द्विजावरो जुगधर्मपालो वन्दे जगत्प्रियकरो करुणावतारो। लादिनीशक्तिस्वरूपाय गौरङ्गसुहृदाय च भक्तशक्तिप्रदनाय गदाधर नमस्तु। हे कृष्ण करुणा सिन्धो दीनबन्धो जगत्पते गोपेश गोपीका कन्त राधा कन्त नमस्तुते। राधे वृन्दवनाधीशे करुणाम्बेतवाहिनि कृपया निजपादब्जादस्यन्मह्यं प्रदीयतम्। भक्त्या विहीनाय अपराधलक्षये हिप्ता शाकमादितरङ्गमादिये कृपामयि त्वं शरणां कृपानं वृन्दे नमस्ते शरणारविन्दम्। वृन्देन्मस्ते शरणारविन्दम्। श्री सचिनन्दन गौरहरि की जय। श्री हरिनाम प्रभु की जय। श्री एकादशी की जय। गौर भक्त वृंद की जय। गौर प्रमानंद हरि हरि बोल। सो वेलकम टू ऑल ऑफ यू। प्रणाम। थैंक्स सो मच फॉर योर प्रेजेंस, योर कंपनी, योर एसोसिएशन। And as we say yesterday, your time, your valuable time, which is none different from Krishna himself. So thank you for blessing me and blessing each other with Krishna in the form of time and in the form of presence, which invokes Krishna's attention and Krishna's presence for sure. So, So today we are continuing with a series of lectures that we began yesterday. Three-part series on self-love and bhakti, learning to relate to ourselves, basically. So for those who were not present yesterday, I will make just a brief summary of what we touched upon one day ago. Basically, we explain our title, self-love in bhakti, and confirm that that's a possible thesis, so to say. You can have Not only you can have self-love in bhakti, but you cannot have bhakti without self-love, and you cannot have self-love without bhakti. So we were exploring the possibilities of what real self-love means in the context of bhakti, how you can love yourself in the context of being loved by Krishna. The main thesis was that one. Krishna loves you unconditionally. You are loved by Krishna. And we want to reciprocate loving Krishna in return. And loving Krishna implies loving all the things that Krishna loves. And you happen to be one of those. So you need to learn to love yourself in the context of loving Krishna, basically. And we also quoted a famous verse from the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, in which Krishna himself somehow confirms this point by describing the soul as Ascharya, which basically means translated as amazing, but it can translate in so many other ways. Now, the soul is, as we say, this Ascetic can mean miracle, can mean shock, can mean wonder, can mean... You need water, Sumati? Really? Okay, if you need more, here it is. No, no, it's okay. Life happens. So we describe, according to this verse of the Gita, Krishna himself is saying the soul is amazing. So that's Krishna's opinion, who we are to contradict that. So how we can contact the amazingness of ourselves in a humble way, realistic way, because as we say, we are amazing, but we are not our own creation. So this is not a reason to become proud of self-centered and so on and so forth. So to see, to express self-love in the context of bhakti. We yesterday also analyzed the consequences of not doing so, how bhakti looks when there is no self-love here, there. And just an emphasis, and you have to love Krishna, surrender to God, but everything else is not appearing in the picture, so to say. There's not an integration of loving everything in the context of loving Krishna, basically. Because loving Krishna means loving everything else by extension. Because nothing exists, ultimately, disconnected, unrelated from God. So if I love God, my love for God has to be reflected in how I relate to everything else. There is no escape from that, fortunately. So how much you love God will be seen in how much you relate with everything else, which exists in connection with Him. So we analyze a little bit about that, how bhakti looks without self-love. It was not a very auspicious prospect. And we also look how self-love looks without bhakti. And it was equally terrifying, basically. Selfishness, self-centeredness, narcissism, self-absorption. And that's not self-love at all. Like we were talking, we were describing self-love without bhakti. And I remember at one point, one of the devotees was, but that's not self-love at all. Yes, yeah, that's the idea. You cannot have self-love without bhakti, but you cannot have real bhakti without self-love either. So the two of them not only balance each other, complement each other, ultimately the two of them are inseparable or kind of synonymous. So that, those were some of the main points that we shared yesterday. And today we'll continue unfolding some of the implications of these ideas, basically. And again, what we are talking here today is Gaudiya Siddhanta. In other words, it's part of the perfected conclusions of our tradition. I'm not bringing here a watered-down, new-agey version of Gaudiya Vaishnavism, but we are talking about, in our tradition, we'll call that Atma Tattva, for example, which means the truth about the soul. Now, there are different truths or different categories of existence, different tattvas, no? Guru tattva, bhakti tattva, atma tattva, and so on and so forth. So atma tattva is one of them, the truth about the soul. And of course, we can say in that connection, we are not the body, we are spiritual souls. That's part of that, but that's not the only thing we can say about in terms of atma tattva. Or the atma is an eternal servant of Krishna. Of course, yes, but we can say way more things about that. So what we are talking now is also Atma Tattva, because Atma Tattva implies whatever is related to the soul. All the truths concerning the soul fall into the category of Atma Tattva. So trying to speak and learn how to express self-love, that's part of Atma Tattva, basically. It's not separate. For example, as I was saying, to analyze how each soul is unconditionally loved by Krishna. And in that context, as I mentioned, how we should learn to love ourselves, because we have to love what Krishna loves, all that falls under the category of Atma Tattva, or knowledge of the soul. The other day I was reading ninth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, and I came across verse 32, which is very interesting. In which, because Krishna is saying there in this connection, he's using another expression. He's using the expression adhyatma vidya, which is another way of saying atma tattva, knowledge about the soul, adhyatma vidya. And he says, of all vidya, of all knowledge, I am that knowledge. I am the knowledge of the soul. I am Adhyatma Vidya. Mm-hmm. So Dharma, welcome.
Thank you.
Nice to see you.
Thank you.
So it's interesting what this verse says, because there are Krishna saying, of all knowledge, and there are different forms and types of knowledge, I am Adhyatma Vidya, or I am Atma Tattva. I am the knowledge concerning the soul. So if Krishna is saying, I'm not different from that knowledge, and if the knowledge of the soul includes self-love, ultimately you can say God becomes fully manifest when we learn to love ourselves, when we embrace this aspect of Atma Tattva called self-love, in the context of his unconditional love for us. Krishna says, I'm not different from that knowledge. You follow my point? No.
Yes,
to be honest, no problem. Now Krishna said, I'm not different from the knowledge about the soul. Knowledge about the soul implies many things. One of them is, know you are being loved by Krishna, and in that context, loving yourself, because you have to love what he loves. So that's Atma Tattva. And Krishna says, I'm not different from that. So he becomes, in other words, he becomes fully present, fully manifest, because he's not different from that when we embrace proper self-loving bhakti. And this is confirmed in many sections in the scriptures. One of them that I like to quote is the official definition of bhakti in our tradition given by Srila Rupa Goswami. Nyavilasita shunyam jnana karmadhyana vritam manukulyena krishnano shilanam bhakti rutama. Bhakti rasamrita sindhu. 1.1.11. For those who do not believe me, you can go there, you will find it there. So in this verse, Rupa Goswami is describing what's bhakti, what's uttam bhakti, which for us, that's bhakti. And when the time comes for explaining the word anushilanam, in the purport, in the commentary to that verse, Srila Jiva Goswami mentions that anushilanam means to serve directly Krishna or to serve those things related to Krishna. And again, everything happens to be related to Krishna. There's nothing that exists unrelated to Krishna. If we will posit that possibility, we are becoming dualists. We are creating two realities. But reality is non-dual. The Bhagavatam begins, Advaya Gyan Tatpa. Vadanti Tat Tatpa Abhidas Tatpam Yad Gyanam Advayam. Bhagavatam begins saying, reality is non-dual consciousness. You cannot create two realities. When we try to do that, we call that Maya, something that is not possible, although it seems possible, but it's not possible. So everything is related to Krishna. So here, Jiva Goswami makes this point. No? Anushilanam, which is the engagement of all our faculties for the pleasure of the Lord, includes not only service, direct service to Bhagavan, but to those things which are related to him. And he says, because we include whatever is related to Krishna, and not only Krishna, in this definition, he says, this definition avoids the fault of being too narrow. In other words, if we only conceive bhakti in terms of serving Krishna, you are being too narrow. Your bhakti is narrow-minded. When you expand your vision to the point of saying, okay, bhakti includes serving whatever is related to Krishna, and that happens to be everything in existence, then you are getting it. Then you are understanding what's the ultimate definition of bhakti. It has to be all-encompassing, wholesome, holistic, all-embracing, including us. Again, I'm talking about self-love in bhakti. So you have to love Krishna. Everything which is related to Krishna, we happen to be related to Krishna. We have to learn to love ourselves, as difficult as it is. Because as we said yesterday, I will continue to show today, this is not so easy to do. Although on a superficial level, it may sound like a very cheap form of self-indulgence, I love myself. If you try to do it from the right place, that's not so easy. That's pretty challenging. And probably that's why many of us do not even try. Because we know that will be a hard battle. to do it from the right place. Again, it's easy to do things from the wrong place. That's the easy thing to do. You can do everything from the wrong place in a minute. Of course, then it becomes quite complex, quite difficult. But to do things from the right place, in the right context, in a balanced way, that's always a challenge, a beautiful challenge. So by loving God, by attending the center, everything else has to be included in that, including us. No? Famous verse in the Bhagavatam, famous example, when you are watering, putting the water in the root of a plant, instead of throwing it into each leaf and branch. You water the root, and the water is transmitted to every single part of the plant. So the watering represents our love. The plant, the root is Krishna, and everything else is everything else, including us. So if you pour water on the root, if you love Krishna, naturally that has to be expressed in every other part of the plant, including us. Or when the Shastra is saying, jasmim vijñate sarvam ipam vijñatam bhavati, for example, by knowing him, you know everything else. By knowing Krishna, you know everything else. So what's the highest type of knowing, according to Krishna? He's not different from that, but the highest type of knowing. Chapter 9, Bhagavad Gita, verse 2.
Rajavidya.
Thank you. Yes. So Rajavidya, the king of Vidya, or knowledge, is bhakti, basically. He's talking about bhakti there. No? So the highest form of knowing someone is love, in other words. I think it makes sense. Not just knowing someone intellectually, but loving the person. You get to know the person most comprehensively. So here, this line from the scripture says, by knowing God, you know everything else. And if not, the highest form of knowing is loving, means by loving God, you love everything else. Everything else, including yourself. Because it makes no sense. I'm loving everything else, and I hate myself. Or I'm totally evasive, indifferent, whatever. But I love everything else. That doesn't align with the very definition of love, so to say. That's not unconditional love, that's conditional. I love everyone except for one person. That's conditional love, and that's not love. Conditional love is not love. Love must be unconditional by definition. Of course, all of this may sound beautiful, or maybe not, maybe sounds terrifying for some of us, I don't know. But my point here is that as glorious, as beautiful as this idea sounds, hopefully, there is also a price to pay, as we were saying, because to love everything or to love ourselves, understanding that we are connected with Krishna means also understanding that everything else is connected with him, and therefore everything else should be loved as well. So when I'm talking here about self-love in bhakti, it's not, okay, it's all about me now. No. It's about loving everything in connection to the center. We happen to be one aspect of that everything, but there's lots of other guys like all of you who are also part of that everything. And especially those guys that you don't like that much, those also fall into the list. Especially those, as we say yesterday, quoting Dorothy Day, you know, this Christian mystic, she will say, I only love God as much as I love the person I love the least. That sounded like epiphany. I repeat it two times for better impact. I only love God as much as I love the person I love the least. The nature of divine love is such that it has to be reflected in every direction, especially in those directions that we usually won't love, but we will hate or we will reject. The power and reach of bhakti is such that they will encompass everything. If that's not happening, still our bhakti is half-baked at best, so to say. As we say yesterday, the definition of the Bhagavatam, of the Uttam Bhagavat, of the highest devotees, that person sees Krishna everywhere and everything in Krishna. Gita 6th chapter also, 30 verse 30, yo mam pasyati sarvatra sarvam cha mam pasyati. He who sees everything in me and me in everything, I'm never lost for him, he's never lost for me. So the highest devotee sees Krishna everywhere, and the highest devotee loves Krishna. So if I love Krishna and I happen to see Krishna everywhere, I'm loving everywhere. I'm loving everything everywhere. Right? Just playing the implications of the statements, right? Because we can read the lines, but we have to play the implication. What does this mean? That means I have to love everyone. If I really love God, I will love everyone. Jesus will say, love your enemy. Then we are talking about love seriously. You just come to me and say, I love all my friends. That's easy. Love your enemy. That's the challenge. Because for loving your enemy, you have to stop having enemies, actually. You have to stop seeing an enemy. That's the moment you have to love your enemy, where your enemy is no longer your enemy, right? So, yeah, there is a price to pay. We have to love everyone. We have to love ourselves. We have to love everything, even. No, sorry if it sounds a little bit too intense what I'm saying, but Brahma Samhita says, God resides in his full presence in every atom. So we should love every atom. Again, it may sound exaggerated, the theory. It's like, that's too much, Maharaj. Loving, falling in love with every atom. It starts to sound a little dysfunctional. No. That's the reality of love. Again, you have to fall in love with reality. Because God is inhabiting every atom. That was Prahlad's vision, right? With Hiranyakashipu was about to kill him. Where is your God? He's nowhere. I cannot see him. And Prahlad was like, where is he not? I'm seeing the presence of my beloved everywhere. That was his natural conversation with reality. Where is he not? I'm trying not to see him, but it's not working. He happens to be everywhere. Wow. So in that connection, we are expected to, again, not only to love Krishna, not only to love others, but even to love ourselves in the proper context. Christianity, they will say, interestingly, love others as you love yourself. That's an interesting line. You have to think about it. Love others as you love yourself. So first, love yourself. Because if you treat yourself like crap, that's how you will treat others, basically, probably. You follow my point? I mean, you have to learn how to relate to yourself, because probably whatever goes out from you to others, it's all a pattern that reflects how you relate to yourself. So we have to treat others nicely. And one of the main things that we can do to treat others nicely is to treat ourselves nicely. Because if I treat myself like crap, probably I will project in that into my environment as well. So loving myself in part is done in the service of others. Again, it's not a selfish enterprise. Loving myself is in the context of loving Krishna. It's never a separate agenda. Bhaktivinoda Thakur will say, Jivadai Krishna Nam Sarva Dharma Sar. The essence of dharma, the essence of religion, the essence of spirituality is Krishna Nam, to chant the name of God, but also Jivadai. First he says Jivadai, to show mercy to all jivas, to be merciful to all jivas. And we happen to be one of those jivas, again, all jivas. Of course, we are not the only jiva either. So be careful I will be extremely merciful only to myself. That's not merciful, again, because if you just become self-absorbed, you're not treating yourself very nicely, actually. That becomes abuse. So that's how it works. So anyhow, I'm sharing some ideas, and I'm sure that even despite sharing what I shared today and what I shared yesterday, in some cases still for us to hear, to listen to the expression, self-love still may invoke some red flags. No, like this sounds like narcissism, like some apasiddhanta, some deviated stuff going on here. Probably because we are not accustomed to hear about these things or these words, like self-love in bhakti. know, although we are explain about that and Shastri's quote. So let me clarify again, once again, one main point that I think is crucial in this connection, that self-love becomes a problem only when we see ourselves as separate units, as isolated entities. That's when it's a problem. That's when it's not self-love, but it's self-centeredness, self-whatever. And it has nothing to do with love, and it has nothing to do with our real self. That's why we are talking about self-love in bhakti. Because in bhakti, if you are practicing bhakti and you are being educated in bhakti, the first stage of that is called sambandha jnana. We have these three stages, sambandha, avideya, and prayojan. Sambandha means, in brief, it says sometimes theory, practice, result. Right? So the theory, the thesis, is called sambandha jnana. Now, what does it mean, sambandha jnana, interestingly? Jnana means knowledge, and sambandha means, bandha means bond, and sam means everything. So sambandha jnana is the knowledge of how everything is connected to each other, to everything. Sambandha jnana is the knowledge of the interconnectedness of everything. In other words, sambandha jnana teaches us that we do not exist in isolation. You follow my point? So when you say, I will express self-love, you will have this foundation. You are not alone. You are not disconnected from the whole, from the center. So you are not a separated unit, so to say. That's the problem. The only problem is separatedness. When we experience ourselves as a separated entity, not connected with the center. That's why yoga means link, bond, connection, as we were talking to today in the morning in our Istagosti. The Bhagavad Gita depicts this scenario from the very beginning. First verse of the Gita is, if you take it symbolically, it's depicting this dualism of the mind. Kuru Pandava. Dharma Kshetri Kuru Kshetri Samabhita Yujutsava Pandavas Mamukas Chaiva Kima Kurvata Sanjaya. So there Dhritarashtra is asking in terms of, what did my sons do? And what about the sons of Pandu? And so it's creating this like dichotomy. There are two groups here, which speaks about the dualism in the mind that creates the actual battlefield. So how that Krishna eventually will reply to that, every single chapter of the Bhagavad Gita finishes with the word yoga. Sankhya yoga, karma yoga, jnana yoga, dhyana yoga, bhakti yoga, yoga yoga. Yoga means union, bonding, connection. To counteract this separatedness that makes us see ourselves disconnected from each other. That's the actual problem. The self-love, quote-unquote, that happens in that separatedness, that's a problem. When we express self-love with proper sambandha, with proper awareness of everything in connection to everything, that's not a problem. You follow my point? So self-love is not a problem. Seeing ourselves separate is a problem. When we see ourselves separated, not only self-love is a problem, everything is a problem. Or everything becomes a symptom of the real problem, which is you see yourself for what you are not. When you are absorbed in duality, dvitiya, instead of advitiya, instead of realizing the non-dual nature of reality, you see yourself and everything in dualistic terms, separatedness, fragmented consciousness. Bhayam, fear comes. Because you are living in an unnatural way. You are not living from who you are. You are without source, without shelter, without connection, without support. You are not part of something bigger than yourself. That's terrifying, for sure. That's terrifying. So we need to bring this sambandha again, to remind ourselves, I'm connected with God. I'm connected with everyone. Everything is connected with everything. I don't want to sound like, again, New Age, that's the truth. That's the truth of reality. Everything is connected with everything. The words of Father Richard Rohr. Recently, I had the chance of visiting him, and he has this famous quote and book. He says, everything belongs. Just in two words, he summarized my last 15 minutes of talking. Everything belongs. We will say in our tradition, Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam, there's only one family. It's the same way, saying the same thing. There's only one family. There are not two families, because everything is interconnected. We are part of a one universal family with one common center and everything constellated around it. Basically, when we forget that, when we become distracted from that, that's the problem. And whatever we want to do, self-love, eating, sleeping, playing golf, everything becomes a problem in that context, so to say, right? So we should live our lives knowing that everything is connected, interconnected with God in the center. At least in theory, I know that probably we don't have the vision of that. We don't see in Vigyan, we don't have full realization of that fact. But at least we should embrace the theory and understand that's how reality should be looked upon. I don't have the vision yet, but I know that's how it looks. So the fact that I'm not seeing that is just showing that I need to continue awakening and growing. But that's how reality looks like. Non-dual, interconnected, everything is integrated, it's full of wholeness. Now we see lots of holes without the W, whole, wholeness of that type. But we want to realize the wholeness, W of reality. So again, all this in the context of self-love. When I express self-love, I keep in mind, I'm not an isolated unit. I'm an integrated unit. I exist in relationship to others. Without relationship to others, I stop existing. If you will. If somehow I disconnect from my relationships, if I try to live as if a non-relational being, dread starts to come very quickly. So if we properly understood this idea of self-love in bhakti, instead of becoming a narcissistic tendency that makes us forget who we really are, it's exactly the opposite. Self-loving bhakti becomes a constant reminder of who I actually am. I am a unit of relationality connected with the center, revolving around God, and everything is connected to that. In order to practice self-loving bhakti, I'm forced to enter into that space. And the opposite of that, as we say, is duality. When I don't see the unity of everything. Everything is isolated, disconnected, separated. And in the beginning, we can become distracted of that, from that fact. We can become distracted from the fact that everything is connected. And we return to reality. Oh, no, everything is connected. But at some point, we can become distracted, and our distraction becomes our reality. That's a problem. One thing is you become distracted, and you realize, oh, I became distracted. Let's go back to reality. Another thing is you become so distracted that your distraction becomes reality. And you become convinced this is it. So that's the actual problem, this separatedness. And when we are seeing ourselves as separated beings, even when we try to love in that context, to love others, to love ourselves, the consequences are catastrophic. Short, middle, long term. Unsustainable. Yeah, so it's important to express self-love in bhakti from a healthy perspective, with a non-dual foundation. Again, I think we Gaudiya Vaishnavas need to emphasize non-dual thinking, because historically we may have related non-duality with impersonalism, with Advaita Vedanta. That's non-dual. Advaita means non-dual. But our tradition has it an Advaita side of the equation, bid a bid. No. So everything is one, everything is Krishna, a bid and bid. There is difference. Everything is connected to him, is an expression of his energies and so on. But everything exists in connection to him. That's foundational understanding. If we don't understand that properly, in our tradition, which is so variegated and so diversified, without proper non-dual foundation, you can become extremely dualistic. And I've seen that a lot in many ways. Not only dualistic philosophically, but dualistic in how you relate to others, how you live life, and so on, how you approach the practice. So we need this foundation of non-duality very clearly. Again, the Bhagavatam is saying, this is main theme. At the end of the Bhagavatam, Bhagavatam is saying, the whole topic of this book has been non-dual reality. That's what the Bhagavatam is about. That's the term used by the Bhagavatam, Advitya. Without it, we can become dualistic. We can think, even like I mentioned in the book, in Radical Personalism. No? And I say that to devotees, and they, most of them confess yes. No? Like I say, for example, when you think about Mahaprabhu and Vamandev and Kurma and Varaha and Narayan and Vishnu and Krishna, do you actually realize that all of them are the same person? Or do you relate to them like different guys? And most of them say, yeah. Right? So we have to pay attention to those things, because we are not polytheistic. No? We are not thinking there are many gods. There's only one God, multi-expressed, so to say. Bahu Murti Ekamurti Kam, Akura says in the Bhagavatam. You are one person, you have one form, and you express that one form in multiple forms. So yeah, non-dual thinking, it's very foundational, very important. And on that foundation, we can express self-love in bhakti in a healthy way. But as we say before, and I would like to go into the last section of the presentation today before entertaining questions, it's not easy to embrace self-love in bhakti. Let's be realistic. The journey won't be easy. And loving yourself may be more difficult than you think. Why? Because probably we are not accustomed to love ourselves. We are not accustomed to even thinking those terms, to even talking those terms. As we were yesterday saying to some of the devotees, make the exercise of looking yourself in the mirror and say, some of you are starting to tremble now. What will Mara say now? In the context of what I'm talking, not in a narcissistic way, you can say, I love myself. And see how you feel. See what comes as a result of that. I love myself, I will accept myself unconditionally. Try to be courageous enough to look yourself at the mirror and say that. We don't need to go to the bathroom now and do that. We don't want to break Pranada's mirror in the bathroom. You can try at home. But see what happens as a result. I love myself, I will accept myself unconditionally from the proper place. Again, I've given context. From which place to say that. And see if there is silence, is there inner confirmation, is there support, faith, hope, or maybe voices of self-loathing and shame and guilt and unworthiness start to appear. I'm like, how can you say that? Are you not ashamed? Who do you think you are to say the things? You shouldn't love yourself. You should love Krishna. You are completely unlovable. You are unworthy, blah, 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 blah. And maybe you try harder and say, no. Krishna has already accepted me fully. Krishna loves me unconditionally. Despite all my brokenness and my messiness as a human being nowadays. And that's true, and that's beautiful. But maybe you bring forth that new argument, and the voices take that argument to take even more strength. Yeah, you are broken and you are messy. No? But let's go deeper in that direction. How broke you are. No? Self-deprecation and self-love. And you just a parade of weepings start to come. No? Like one after another, after another. Which becomes self-centeredness at the end of the day. It becomes absorption in what I'm not. So that's not humility, just in case. No? Because humility is crucial. And as crucial as it is, it's crucial to understand correctly what's humility. Like surrender. You know, these crucial cardinal virtues in our tradition. Because they are so important, we will spend lots of time trying to understand them correctly. Because those words that are most often used, like you should surrender, you should this, you should become, the more you use them in massively, many times the more they tend to be misread and misinterpreted and taken out of context and become even used for the opposite and create trauma and create fear, intimidation, and create dysfunction of all types. In the name of humility and surrender, we can open so many doors to abuse, right? And you don't have to, you cannot say anything. Be humble, surrender. We call that sins of omission. There's sins of commission, and others are part of sins of omission. I know something's not going on, something's going on bad, but I will be humble and surrender and not say anything. That's not humble and surrender. That's complex of crime, basically. So to say, one level or another. So again, Krishna repeatedly has said in the Gita, you are amazing. In this famous Acharya verse 229, he's saying it three times. Imagine Krishna coming in front of you and saying, you're amazing, amazing, amazing. As I said yesterday, most of you wish, when my husband will say that one day, once a week at least, once a year, on our anniversary. Does Mitra say that sometimes?
Always.
Okay. They paid me before the class to make this part of it. So we arranged at the end of the class. So yeah, Krishna is saying that. I'm not saying that if Mitra tells you that, that's less. But imagine that Krishna is telling you that. You're amazing. You're a miracle. Acharya can mean miracle. Imagine God himself in front of you telling you, you're a miracle. You're a unit of wonder. I'm in wonder in front of you. You are shockingly extraordinary. All those are the meaning of Acharya. I'm not exaggerating. I'm just saying what Krishna, repeating what Krishna is saying. But despite that, for some reason, we somehow are not convinced yet. No. So Krishna loves you, but I don't love me. No. That's interesting, right? And Krishna loves you, but I don't agree with him, basically, on this one. I think he missed it. There's some problem there. How can he love me? How can he love me, Krishna? And I'm absolutely unlovable. We can be so convinced that we are trying to start a debate with Bhagavan, trying to convince him back. No, you shouldn't love me. Well, that's the thing we need the most, actually. So he is saying that, I love you, you're amazing, but still some voices are lurking. No, you're not good, you are ugly, you're worthless, you're despicable, you're shameless, you're nobody, basically. Unless you demonstrate the opposite. Mentesis, that's how it works. You are the worst thing on earth unless you demonstrate the opposite. So then we start on to this exhausting, impossible struggle to, okay, I have to earn Krishna's love. I have to make myself lovable. I have to deserve. I have to perform at some point on some level of perfection that is impossible. So finally, something good can come of me, something like that. So if we have that orientation to life, life is a torture from day one, in the beginning. And I know many devotees who orient their practice, their sadhana, from that place, unfortunately. I'm not lovable. Krishna doesn't love me yet, unless I become a pure devotee, which doesn't speak so nice about Krishna to say that. Try to play out. If I say, Krishna will only love me when I become a pure devotee, that doesn't speak well at all about him. He's just like there, I don't love you. Send me a message when you become a Premi Bhakta, and I may feel something for you at that point. That's not all attractive. That's the all unattractive. So be careful of making the all attractive the all unattractive. Because if you enter into that, again, if we become convinced, I'm nothing unless I demonstrate the opposite. Whether you try to become something else or you become convinced, I cannot become that, but at least I will convince others that I'm something else. So you enter into this character performance and trying to seeing something in front of us. I mean, that's the opposite of spiritual life, which is all about transparency, vulnerability, nakedness, honesty, sincerity, and acknowledging I am already loved for who I am, whatever I am. But again, it's important that we are aware that it can be a struggle, and still we may be in what an author called the trance of unworthiness. She refers to this as a type of trance. Many of us are like in a form of samadhi, but not a spiritual one. And a trance of unworthiness. I'm unworthy. And it's a soundtrack that never stops. Or like Harry Nguyen will say, the temptation of self-dejection. We are tempted to reject ourselves. Raise your hand, those who do not know what I'm talking about. Okay, no hands raised. Since we are talking about some pretty universal stuff here. And I would say personally that that's probably the greatest trap in our spiritual progress. Not necessarily things like Kanaka, Kamini, Pratishtha. Sometimes we mention like success, popularity, sense enjoyment, fame. But I will say that a greater temptation, a greater trap is self-dejection. That's even more ingrained, more subtle, more pervading, so to say. And the other thing comes as a byproduct of that. For me, that's a bigger picture in Anartha Nivritti. To understand again, avidya first, ignorance of who I am, then comes this dualistic mentality. I see reality as a broken thing, separated. Then comes fear, shame, self-rejection, even arrogance or things like that. And even if someone says, no, Maharaj, I disagree with you, you're totally free to do so. But let me argue with you for a moment. Someone may say, I disagree with you. I think that arrogance, I'm more tempted by arrogance than by self-dejection. To give an example. Because arrogance, many times we hear, is kind of one of the worst stuff. And I'm not here praising arrogance, just putting it in its place. I would say that arrogance is not a greater temptation than self-dejection. Actually, is the other side of self-rejection. Because what's arrogance? Arrogance means putting yourself on a pedestal to avoid being seen as you actually see yourself, which is unworthy and unlovable. That's generally arrogance. Behind arrogance, if someone is too arrogant, that means that person is just escaping, creating a facade so he or she doesn't have to confront how they see themselves as totally unworthy. So you just create another side of that same coin and put yourself on a pedestal. You follow my point? So even if you say arrogance is the worst, but self-dejection is no different from that. So as you can see, self-rejection is not only the opposite of self-love in bhakti, but in one sense is the greatest enemy of our spiritual life. Because this voice of self-rejection is contradicting constantly this other voice that Krishna sends to us saying, I love you. Krishna is telling you that 24/7. How much we are attentive to that frequency, I don't know. But Krishna is saying, I love you and I accept you unconditionally and fully right now. You don't have to earn this. It's a gift given. So self-rejection is the opposite. Self-rejection is, that's not possible. It's trying to cancel Krishna's voice in our heart. Try to imagine how dangerous that is. And by contrast, of course, when we are able to reclaim the truth of our core existence, when we are able to define ourselves as, I am someone who is loved by God. Okay, then we are reaching home. That's our core truth. Core truth of our existence is, you are loved by Krishna. And you express self-love in that connection, self-love in bhakti. And even, of course, Just to conclude. I know we are still on the path. We have imperfections. We have limitations. We are not fully enlightened beings, at least not myself, just in case I'm making that clear. Don't put me in any pedestal, please. So how to deal with that in the context of self-loving bhakti? Self-loving bhakti doesn't mean like, okay, I have no more anarthas, am I completely transcendent? That's not about it. It's just in the context of self-loving bhakti, you also treat yourself in your limited situation with a little bit more of compassion also. We can have mistakes, but also we can reframe our mistakes. The mistakes are not defining who I am. Limitations and imperfection are not defining who I am, but also there are further opportunity for growth, basically. It's not that I'm promoting let's make mistakes, but when I make a mistake, I can learn from that. That's it. Let's not over-identify with that and just, I did this wrong, and I'm this, and I'm that. No, I did this wrong. Let's learn a lesson from this. Like we were saying, generally we make more progress many times by doing it wrong than by doing it right. Sometimes we do it right and we become self-complacent, proud, who knows what. We do it wrong, we become humbled, and we learn the lesson. So if we do something wrong, of course, there is place to acknowledge that. Even if I make someone suffer, there is place to feel repentant, to experience healthy guilt. There is place for that. But that's not the same as self-rejection and toxic shame. There's a difference between that. Try to see the difference. No? The difference between guilt and shame is guilt is I did something bad and I will work to improve it. Shame is, I am something bad. I'm defined by badness. I'm ontologically flawed. That's shame, toxic shame. But healthy guilt is, I acknowledge my mistake, I take responsibility, and I try to learn and grow. That's the idea, that's great. But, yeah, things like toxic shame is like, you are bad. In your essence, your core substance, you are flawed, and therefore you are unlovable, blah, 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 blah. So this we have to avoid because it opposes reality. You are not something bad in substance. Again, Krishna is saying you are wonderful. You are amazing. Multiply for three. Acharya, 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 he says, for the sake of emphasis. We are exactly the opposite of something bad. The Atma, the soul. Who we are, not our own creation, but who we happen to be. Try to understand, but we are a miracle, but I'm not my own creation. I'm not my own miracle, but I happen to be a miracle by the fact of being an Atma, and each one of you as well. So why not celebrate that instead of shaming ourselves for something that we are not and entering into that realm of identifying ourselves in a way that opposes reality, basically. So we are something, the soul is something wonderful that God loves infinitely. Put it like that. And we should learn to love that as well. Again, whatever Krishna is loving, I want to love that also. If I want to love Krishna, I want to love what he loves. That's our philosophy. I want to love Krishna, okay. I want to love what he loves because I love him so much. Whatever he loves, I want to love. And he happens to love everything because he's made of love. Krishna doesn't have love. He's made of love. So if you are made of love, you cannot not love. You follow? Like we were saying today in the morning, Krishna has his limitations also. He cannot not love, for example. There are certain things God cannot do. God cannot stop being God. God cannot not love. Because that goes against his very nature and constitution. He's made of that. So he's made of love. He cannot not love. He loves everything. So, including us. We want to love him. We will love everything. Anyhow. A few words that I want to share today in like an extended reflection of what we shared yesterday. And tomorrow we'll have our last meeting in connection to this topic at Art and Cities Place, same time for those who would like to come. And we'll delve into much, a little bit more detail into God's unconditional love for us. What does it mean that Krishna loves us unconditionally? How to understand that? How that can facilitate our expression of self-love in bhakti? And also, not only it's but we'll reflect on, not only it's important to know that we are loved by God and therefore we are lovable, but also we need to become that. We need to enter into that, to inhabit that idea, to live in that reality, to fully embody and integrate this perspective in our daily life. So we'll share some thoughts on that also. Anyhow, thank you so much for your attention. We have a few more minutes for a few questions, Brenda.
Yes,
okay. If there is any question or comment or something you would like to share, Keshav Gopal Prabhu. Yeah.
Thank you, Maharaj, for this class.
Thank you.
Very nice topic. How do we reconcile between the prayer and the mood of Mahaprabhu of the Shikshashakam? Into that mood of being almost I'm more humble than grass. So how do we reconcile that and feeling loved or worthy in that sense?
Okay, thank you. Yeah, so the third verse of Shikshastakam, of course, for us is very important. Very important is little. I like to say that the third verse of Shikshastakam is more important than the Maha Mantra. In which sense? Don't all get alarmed, please. But Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami say, if you want to attain the goal of life, prem, by chanting the Maha Mantra, you have to chant it, embracing the spirit of the third verse. If not, you can be chanting for millions of lifetimes and the result doesn't come. In that sense, this verse is more important, in the sense that it's giving us the attitude through which we embrace the chanting. So, but of course, that verse can be also interpreted in many ways and also be even weaponized to the point of, you have to be more humble than a blade of grass, more tolerant than the tree. So just keep tolerating while I'm doing all my abuse and nonsense. So that's not the idea. No, that's not the idea. First of all, that's not a verse to throw onto others, so to say, right? You should do this. No, no, it's like, let's go home first. So when Mahaprabhu, and I remember talking on the theme of unconditional love and we being loved unconditionally by Krishna, we gave a class some time ago in New Zealand, I remember, on this third verse in connection to unconditional love. I won't go into detail now, but a few points. So Mahaprabhu in the first line is saying, okay, we are invited to be more humble than a blade of grass. So, and more tolerant than a tree. No? Those are the first two lines. And then he's saying, offer respect to others and not speak respect for yourself, which is kind of another way of saying the first two lines, right? If you are properly humble, properly tolerant, you're not looking respect for you, and you are offering respect to others. Instead, you are tolerating others. You are respecting them. That's qualifying the idea, right? And one point will be, Amani namanadina, no? Don't expect respect, don't look for respect. Why? Because Krishna already loves everyone unconditionally. So first, why you need to be offered respect if you know yourself to be totally loved by God already? So what do you need above that? What can be above that? I mean, you follow. If you really know the most important person in existence loves me infinitely, the idea of I need people to respect me, it's like evaporates, absolutely. You follow? So my point is, you can more easily follow this verse by bringing to presence this idea of you are loved unconditionally by Krishna. And again, not expecting respect is connected with being very humble. I'm fully loved by Krishna. I don't need respect from anyone because I'm receiving the most important thing from the most important person. And then try to offer respect to everyone. Why? Because everyone is loved unconditionally by Krishna. That's the most foundational thing I should respect in each of you. There may be things on the surface which are not worthy of respect, even if you are the worst type of monster as a human being. At the end of the day, still you are a soul, and the soul is loved by Krishna, not the nonsense you may be doing, so to say. the soul is loved by Krishna. So I should respect that. I should honor that. I should be more tolerant than a tree in that connection, so to say. So that's one way of explaining this verse in connection to unconditional love. And by bringing this idea, everyone has been unconditionally loved by God, that facilitates the expression of humility and tolerance. So again, humility doesn't mean degrading yourself, like the famous quote says, no? Humility is not to think less of yourself, but to think of yourself less. Right? That's not the same. It's two words put in a different place, but it's not to think less of yourself. Again, I'm crap, I'm unworthy, that's not humility. But to think of yourself less, in the sense that I'm not the center of the universe, right? It doesn't mean I totally forget about me, but just don't be overtly self-absorbed like if you are Krishna, because you are not. So humility basically means a sincere assessment of reality, like a sober picture of what is what and who is who. That's basically humility. And of course, the humility, ideas like humility or ideas like surrender, which are tied to humility, I like always to define them in connection to awe and wonder. Before surrendering, there has to be awe and wonder, and I will surrender to that. So surrender has to be prefaced by awe and wonder. Or humility. No, I offer respect. I give myself by something that makes me think, wow, I want to honor that, respect that, whatever. Because if not, it becomes some coercive imposition, like some forced thing. You have to be humbled. You have to tolerate. I don't even understand why, but you have to do it. That's not healthy. You may end up doing it externally, out of fear, out of social pressure, out of coercion, but that's not from the heart. So that means nothing in one sense. That gets in the way of your bhakti, as we were talking also today in the morning. Rupa Goswami calls that Niyamagraha. Second verse of Upadeshamrita. He lists these six things that you can do to ruin your bhakti, basically. You want to ruin your bhakti, do these six things. Now, one of them, Niyamagraha. Follow all rules and regulations without having a clue why you are doing those. Right? That's one of the best things to do to spoil the whole bhakti project. Become mechanical, do things out of fear, repetition, without proper feeling and intention in your heart. Become non-intentional and ruin your bhakti. Of course, I'm not proposing that, please. Don't make a reel in my class taking out this promise. Padmanabharaj went officially crazy. but yeah. So yeah, humility, tolerance, all that will take different shapes at different stages of our journey. It's not only one way to express those things. What was humility in day one may get in the way in day two or day 10. And we may need to express a humility that externally may not seem like humility in some cases. Because again, you cannot, you stereotype humility. It means to do like this and to bow your head like this and to talk in a certain tone and to embrace the Swami. You have to put your head down when you embrace Maharaj. He will be on top. Whatever. But at the end of the day, humility is more a profound commitment with surrendering to the truth, to acknowledging the truth, to acknowledging what's on top of us and whatever form it takes. And sometimes humility also means you receive an instruction or an inspiration from above and you do it. So Krishna may inspire you, or Guru may tell you, go and clean the altar. And you are entering the altar and walking on top of the altar. And that sounds like, doesn't seem like you're humble there. But you are doing that following an instruction in service. You follow. And the opposite, you can make a performance of humility externally, but internally just performative. So yeah, at the end, humility is our commitment to the truth. No? So whenever the truth is calling us, whatever we need to take to follow that call, whatever shape that may take, that's secondary. Right. Yeah. Do you have there a copy of Radical Personalism? I would like to share one quote from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur in this connection. But I give you a warning, fasten your seatbelt, please. Yeah. I mean, first I hope to find the quote, because that's like, yeah, where it was. It's easier to check here in the PDF, because search option, that's better. Give me 1 second, because it's connected to this verse, to this third verse. So it's in page, yeah, 370, Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta says, fasten your seatbelts, yeah? Okay. Without cheating anyone, we should boldly proclaim the truth to everyone. All this in the context of this third verse of Shikshasim. If the truth is bitter or unpopular, but bestows blessings on the living entities, we must speak it. Unless we fearlessly speak the truth, the sweet absolute will not be pleased. The aggressive pronouncement of the concrete truth is the crying necessity of the moment. We have to understand what aggressive means. No? For silencing the aggressive propaganda of specific untruths that is being spread all over the world. A chanter of the names of God is necessarily the uncompromising enemy of worldliness and hypocrisy. It is his bounden duty to clearly and frankly oppose any person who tries to deceive and harm himself and others by misrepresenting the truth, whether due to malice or genuine misunderstanding. Humility implies perfect submission to the truth and no sympathy for untruth. Repeat it again for better effect. Humility implies perfect submission to the truth and no sympathy for untruth. Therefore, the professors of pseudo-humility have reason to fear the preaching of God's servants, one of whose duties is to expose the enormous possibility of mischief inherent in various forms of so-called spiritual conduct when they are prostituted for serving the untruth. Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta Ki Jai. Now you know why he was called the Simha Guru. So that's how he will describe humility. Sympathy for truth, no sympathy for untruth. And sometimes in order to express that, you take a stance that seems not too humble. You follow me. And sometimes you may seem humble, but you're just being a passive consumer of some mediocre, complacent, half-baked truth. But externally it seems like, oh, he's so humble. And probably not. We are just taking that stance so we don't have to commit ourselves to truth. So take different shapes according to the situation. Something else? Sorry, I leave you frozen after that quote. Everyone's like, okay, it was good that you fastened your seatbelt. Some other question or comments or thoughts?
I have another question.
Yeah, why not?
So you mentioned Krishna loves everything and everyone. We are part of Krishna.
I mean, he's mentioning that. No, I'm just repeating.
Yes, but is that... That could lead to like some kind of impersonalism. Oh, Krishna loves everyone. I'm part of that. Krishna loves. I'm part of Krishna. Oh, I'm also so great, lovable, and you know, it's kind of like merging.
I will see that way, at least for me and for the ones that we have been sharing this good news, so to say, that has not been the result, because all this happens in a certain way, in a certain context that for me doesn't lend itself to, or impersonalism, or even like laziness, like, okay, Krishna loves me unconditionally, so I can relax because he loves me.
Yeah,
yeah, but you don't love him yet. So the goal of life is to love Krishna. The goal of life is not Krishna to love you. That's already happening. No? Prem Prayojan, the goal of life is Prem, but it's not love from Krishna, it's love for Krishna. Love from Krishna is already happening. So when you know that Krishna is loving you unconditionally, despite lifetime after lifetime, or even denying his existence, and that person remains true and loyal to his unconditional love, that's so moving, at least for me, that the last thing I'm thinking is, I'll relax and just, I'll just relax and abuse that unconditional love. No, that's the last thing. No, what comes is, wow, I'm so moved. I mean, this person has been loving me forever, and I have done nothing to earn that. I have done everything to do in the opposite direction, so to say. And that's that love still there? Wow. You follow, like we were talking some weeks ago, Bhakti Rasa and Sumati, like for lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, we may have constructed mountains of an art as an opposition and dualism and illusion. But in one way, Bhakti is way more powerful than all that. And now in this lifetime, we're able to be talking about all the things despite endless lifetimes of opposition. So that shows also the power of Bhakti, the power of love, when we open to that on some level. So when we awaken to these realities, I wouldn't say that it takes to impersonalism or laziness or conformity, complacency, but it's the opposite. It's like, I'm so moved. I mean, I'm being loved without deserving, without it. What can I do to reciprocate? That's the only question that counts. Now, what to do now? Like how to give something back? It's not that I will eventually deserve it and match Krishna's love, whatever, but I cannot just remain like this. So that's the very meaning of becoming a devotee or a servant. No? In Sanskrit, one of the words for that is kinkara. Like Mahaprabhu will say, Shikshastikam 5, Ayi Nandat Noya Kinkaram. So kinkara means servant, but kinkara means kinkara. Kinkaro means kara means to do, and kin means what. So kinkara means what can I do? Like implying, how can I serve? That's the spirit of kinkara, of a servant. What can I do? What can I do now? I mean, I've been gifted with so much. Now the only question in my mind is, how can I reciprocate? And that question remains with me forever. Because the more I reciprocate, the more love keeps flowing, basically. So the depth increases in a healthy way. The depth of love. Now that's the only way you can counteract the karmic debt, so to say. So yeah, I would say that if we properly explain and express the things, there should be no place for this type of tendencies, like, okay, conformism, laziness, or some form of merging. But that's who Krishna is. Krishna is made of love. I mean, that's repeatedly stated in Shastra. His very swarup, his identity, he's composed of love. So he cannot not love. You have to understand those philosophical principles. God is made of love. He cannot not love. He loves everything. That's his nature. So we are part of that. We are blessed by that. And the only question that remains is kinkara. What can I do now? How to reciprocate? Bhakti has come to my life, has knocked the door. I dare to open that door. Oh my gosh, now I'm like absolutely blessed by that. The only thing that I have to do now is to celebrate. That's why Krishna says in the Gita, Susukam Kartum 9.2, Bhakti is to be performed very joyfully. He's not asking, hey guys, make a show, a performance, seem happy. No, it's not like seem happy. No. Understand the glory of Bhakti, how of an undeserved gift that is, that has blessed your life. And you have nothing else to do but to celebrate. from now till ever, forever. Kirtan means basically that, a celebration of the nature of the gift that has come to us. Technically speaking, all of, if we are serious in bhakti and we are not brutally opposed to bhakti, you are already saved, basically. It's just a matter of time, but you're already saved. And not to become proud, again, it's not like, ah, it's my own merit, I'm saved. But just by the power of bhakti, you're already saved. Krishna says that. Name bhakti pranashati, my devotee never perishes. Neha vikramanasasti pratyavayanavi. In this path of bhakti, there's no loss nor diminution. Yogakshamam vahamyaham. I provide what you lack. I preserve what you have. And so on and so forth. So many lines in Shastra, Krishna giving assurance. You're already protected, saved. You're on the path. You're already there. Because you are doing bhakti, and the goal of bhakti is bhakti. What's our goal? Bhakti. Well, we are already doing bhakti. So we are doing what we want to do for eternity. Technically speaking, we are saved. So our question is shouldn't be so much, when I will be saved, should I be saved? The question is, so what to do with my salvation now? That's the question. We are saved by God's grace, not by my own merit, but God's grace, the power of bhakti. I'm saved. So what to do now? Let's celebrate that and let's extend that possibility to others. That's it. Don't need to get paranoid. Maybe at the end of this life, I will lose the human form of life and become an ant. Because who knows, I stepped onto the shadow of the temple president 35 years ago. Who knows what? We have so many varieties of paranoia still. But to be honest, I'm on a mission to crush all that stuff. That's nonsense. And we can lose so much time and energy thinking all the things that are like an insult to bhakti, basically. If you understand the nature and power of bhakti, and if you are basically open to that and you are not opposing to that brutally, that's it. Bhakti is taking you. The current is taking you. It may take one lifetime, a few lifetimes. I don't care for that. That's no rush. Because you're already doing bhakti. I mean, I don't want to go anywhere to do something else. So we are already doing what we want to do. So where do we want to go? You follow my point? That's the type of positive orientation we have to our practice. Toward the practice, instead of conducting ourselves like, I want to leave this world, I want to go somewhere else, this is bad, I have to reject this. That's not the actual orientation, devotional orientation, that's a mukti-oriented practice. But for us, moksha lagota krit. Mukti, moksha is, in the words of Krishnadas Karash Goswami, kaita dharma. Mukti is a form of cheating for us. Anyhow, susukam, Krishna says, susukam kartam, had to be executed. Sukam means with joy, and susukam means with ultra joy. Now, when you realize the nature of the gift, that you are already saved, that's it. You have to organize a party to celebrate that. And your whole life has to become an extension of that celebration. Anyhow, thank you so much again. We'll continue sharing. So again, for those who would like, tomorrow we'll have our last session at Archana City. And also we have, by the inspiration and time and availability, we have, I will be staying a few more days. So we will be having one more meeting next weekend for those who would like to participate. It will be more East Agosti. Just you can bring any questions you have on any topic and we can talk on that. That will be the other next Saturday. At 5:30 p.m. at Archana City's place, Radha Gopinath Mandir. So just in case if you have time. But tomorrow, same time, also at Archana City's place. We'll see you there. Something else, Brandon?
Is there?
Sorry?
Yes. There's prasadam. Mm-hmm. But before prasadam, if you'd like, Padmanabha Swami's books are here.